I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Only a few months ago, the eyes of the world were riveted on the United Nations. First on a parade of reports from weapons inspectors telling the world what they had found and failed to find in Iraq. Then the high-stakes diplomatic maneuvering among Security Council members over a resolution the U.S. and U.K. wanted to confer a formal blessing on the war. Against the backdrop of the past several weeks, that debate now seems almost quaint. Those arguments overtaken and overwhelmed by the events that have followed. Now that the fighting has stopped, the new arguments are about who should keep the peace and what it should look like, and whether there is now a role for a Security Council that failed to either prevent or authorize the war in Iraq. And with North Korea rattling its saber, the question arises again, whether the council is needed now more than ever, or should be dismissed as a largely irrelevant debating society. Connection listeners, has the Security Council outlived its usefulness, or does it simply need a tune-up? Is the world back to a time where might makes right? Can a center of international law and order function in a world that contains only one superpower? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That is 1-800-423-TALK. And with me this hour are two of the nation's top experts on international law. On the line from Princeton University is Anne Marie Slaughter. She is Dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs and Professor of Politics and Public Affairs at Princeton University. Hi, Anne Marie.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Well, we're glad you could join us. And also Michael Glennon is joining me in the studio. He is a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University and the author of Why the Security Council Failed, an article appearing in the forthcoming issue of Foreign Affairs. Hello, Michael.
Morning, Gail.
Michael, I want to start with you because you make the argument in this article we just mentioned that, in fact, the UN Security Council hasn't been relevant for quite some time now. How so?
Well, in fact, Gail, the Security Council was intended to be more than just relevant. It was intended to be controlling. It was intended to give permission to use force, except in one instance, when states used force to act in their own self-defense. It was intended to give approval, and that approval would be required. But since 1945, there have been over 200 instances in which states have used force without Security Council approval. Most recently, we saw this in Kosovo, in which 19 Western democracies used force against Yugoslavia without the approval of the Security Council. Following that, Kofi Annan made a very historic proposal to the General Assembly, suggesting that we move to a system in which that sort of humanitarian intervention would be permitted. He said sovereignty should not be a shield for gross human rights violations, and that was debated in the General Assembly. And only about one-sixth of the members of the General Assembly agreed with that. So the truth is, as we saw in the Security Council just over the last several months, the world community is really divided right down the middle on this central question of when force can appropriately be used. It's north against south, east against west. There is no consensus on this question. And on top of that, I might just say, there's been a configuration of power that's emerged in the world just over the last few years that makes this consensus all the more difficult to achieve. The United States has been trying to keep a leg up on other nations in the world to preserve its hegemony. China, Russia, France, on the other hand, have been trying to restore the world to a multipolar power structure. That's been their long-term strategic objective. And the collision that we saw in the Security Council last month is the direct result of these incompatible long-term strategic goals.
All right, we're going to be drilling down into some of those points a little more thoroughly over the course of the next hour, but I want to go to Anne Marie to offer perhaps a counter view, because I know, Anne Marie, you've said that the UN fight over Iraq did put its relevance on the line and its credibility, but you believe the upshot of all of that is that it's more important now than ever. Why so?
Well, I think it still could be more important now than ever. And I think without it, we are in a world of might makes right, of anarchy at a time when the potential security threats to all of us from states and from individuals are as frightening as they've ever been. So it is critical that we have a forum for addressing those collectively. In many ways, the way to think about the Security Council and the UN more generally, is it's the worst possible system. It's just better than any of the others, to paraphrase Winston Churchill on democracy. There's no question it is very imperfect, and it has been ignored a great deal in its history, largely because of the stalemate through the Cold War. But since the Cold War ended, it actually was quite active in the 1990s, and it authorized the use of force in the first Gulf War, in Bosnia, in Somalia, in Haiti, and even in Kosovo. It authorized the mission after the fact by essentially then creating a UN mission that is still in Kosovo. Immediately after Kosovo, it authorized sending in a force in East Timor, and there some Security Council members who had been opposed to the intervention in Kosovo realized that the situation had changed and they might not like it, but they went ahead. What we're seeing now is exactly, as Michael says, a change in the power configuration, a change in the nature of the threats the world faces, and we need to change our collective ability to respond to those. And as I said, the Security Council is radically imperfect, but I haven't heard a better alternative out there. And I'd be interested in hearing Michael propose what we should be doing instead.
Well, we will definitely ask that question, but not quite yet, because I think it might be useful for our listeners to back up for just a moment and reflect in a line or two about the Wilson idealism that led to the founding of the old League of Nations. That was also all about mutual self-defense, but clearly didn't work that well because it was not able to prevent World War II. So what did we learn from that failure? What was changed in the subsequent Charter of the United Nations, Michael?
From the failure of the League of Nations?
Yes.
Well, I think that the truth is that the Security Council is largely built on the burnt timbers of the League of Nations. The structure is fundamentally the same. We dropped Article 10 of the Covenant of the League of Nations, which purported to put an obligation on countries to come to the defense of one another. That's the principal reason that it was rejected in the United States Senate. We added a veto in the Security Council, and the idea was to try to reflect the real-world power structure in some way, but that hasn't really worked. The veto, in effect, raises France above India. India didn't even have a seat on the Security Council during the debate on the use of force against Iraq. It raises France to the level of the United States, and gosh sakes, it gives Cameroon and Angola a de facto veto by giving them the chance to decline to provide the necessary ninth vote to get Security Council approval. So this function of maintaining international peace and security is not one that the Council has been able to perform. It does not reflect the real-world power structure accurately enough.
You make an interesting point. Who would have ever thought that Cameroon and Angola and Guinea would get so much attention? Suddenly they became crucial players on this world stage.
They wanted to get onto the Security Council very badly and campaign for it, and I think they had second thoughts about that.
Perhaps. Perhaps they wish not. Anne-Marie?
That's not the right way to think about it. The League, I think the UN is very different from the League. The League really was an idealistic vision of all nations being willing to come to one another's defense. So it was formulated in the way that NATO is now formulated, that said an attack on one is an attack on all, and all nations will rally to repel the attacker. Well, you know, when Japan invaded Manchuria, the rest of the world did not think that was an attack on it. When Italy had invaded Ethiopia, when Hitler remilitarized the Rhineland, other nations were not willing to act as a security alliance. It was all also, of course, the U.S. was never a part of the League, and there was no recognition of the power structure. The U.N. Is not about everyone coming to each other's defense. It is a mutual agreement not to use force unless there's authorization by the Security Council. It recognized that the power structure was critical, and that unless you got the assent of the permanent members, France, Britain, China, Russia, and the United States, you would not use force. And there's no question that as a result, where there was a stalemate between the United States and the Soviet Union, countries sometimes took the law into their own hands, sometimes often went to other international organizations to authorize the use of force. But Michael overlooks the huge achievement of the UN, which is that nations do not think it's legitimate to use force without the authorization either of the UN or of another body such as NATO. And even now, the United States went to war in Iraq saying that it was authorized to do so by the Security Council because of a whole string of resolutions that the Security Council had passed and that then were not honored. That's a very important change, given that for two millennia, nations went to war whenever they felt like it. And at this point, with weapons of mass destruction, to return to a world in which you don't need any authorization and you don't even have to try to get authorization is really a terrifying vision. One more point on the Cameroon and Guinea and Chile. It's not the individual states that matter. What it was, I think, relevant is you had a standoff between the United States and Britain on the one hand and France and Russia on the other, with China there, not in the end clear how China was going to vote, probably would have abstained. And in the middle, you had six smaller countries who represented a lot of all the different continents of the world and the smaller countries, and they really weren't prepared to go either way. They wouldn't authorize force, but had the French and the Russians sought a resolution condemning the use of force, I don't think they would have voted for that either. And in that way, they really did reflect a balance of world opinion. There were those who felt very strongly we had to do this, and those who felt that the case wasn't proved, even though Saddam Hussein had a threat. And so you got stalemate, and in there we went ahead. And now the question is, how do you pick up the pieces and figure out how this doesn't happen the next time?
Well, the suggestion that the United States was somehow playing by the rules is just utter nonsense. The United States went to the Security Council and told it at the outset, and Colin Powell was very clear about this, that it would not be bound by a decision of the Security Council. It said, of course, look, it's not going to confront the Security Council unnecessarily. It made this make-weight argument that the prior resolutions somehow authorized the use of force against Iraq. But I don't think you yourself buy that argument, Anne-Marie. Most international lawyers don't. Few of them have actually read the resolutions, but those who do know that that's a bogus argument. No, the United States went to
What's a bogus argument?
The argument that 678 and 687 somehow authorized the use of force against Iraq. That is not a persuasive argument. Now, let me finish, if I may. So the United States went to the Security Council and said, look, we would like this authorization for political reasons. The purpose of getting the authorization was to help our friend and ally Tony Blair. Everybody knows that. The United States did not go to the Security Council to satisfy some legal requirement. It said it would act even if the United Nations Security Council did not approve it. That is not the way the system was supposed to work.
Okay, clearly more to be said here. Anne-Marie will give you a chance to respond after we take a quick break. Connection listeners, this hour we're looking at the United Nations Security Council and assessing the prospects for its future. Can the Council realize its mission of ensuring peace and security in the world? What has to change in order for it to achieve that mission? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be back after this break. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris. We're discussing the United Nations Security Council this hour and its recent failures in the eyes of some and successes in the eyes of others. With me on the program are Anne-Marie Slaughter, Dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University, and Michael Glennon, President of International Law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University.
Professor, not president.
I beg your pardon.
Sorry.
You're right.
I'd love to be president.
We also want to hear from you as well. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Anne-Marie, I want to go to you first. You probably have been waiting for a chance to respond to what Michael was saying as we went into a break about the political and legal decisions involved in terms of the U.S. going to the Security Council.
Well, So Michael says, look, the whole thing was a sham. The United States never intended to abide by the Security Council, and it was just a political move. Let me say
I
outset.
I beg to differ. I didn't say that.
Well, okay. Michael, why don't you restate it, and then we'll get Anne-Marie to respond to it.
Well, I think I stated it as I wanted to state it before, but I certainly never said it was a sham.
Well, I thought you
Or that we never intended to comply with the United Nations Charter. That's far from what I said. I mean, I believe that at the outset we surely did intend to comply with the United Nations Charter. Look, I think everybody sat down in San Francisco in 1945.
I meant in September, Mike. I meant the Bush administration this time from September through March in terms of how do we understand what has just happened?
That's correct.
I heard you saying was that the president had said from the beginning that we didn't need the UN's permission, and hence it was not a real effort to go to the Security Council. That's what I was trying to respond to.
I believe that the United States would never have complied with the judgment of the Security Council that it had intended to go to war against Iraq, whatever the Security Council did or did not do.
Well, George Bush pretty much made that plain, didn't he say? We're
Absolutely.
Prepared to go it alone.
And you can only...
Well, yeah, but that's... Can I
sure.
now respond to that point? He said in September, he said in what I think was a very important speech, he turned to the UN and he said, it's time for the UN to be a serious player in international security and live up to its own resolutions or enforce its own resolutions. You can't keep passing resolutions and then accept their violation. And at that point, it took 2 months to negotiate Resolution 1441, where the entire Security Council agreed that Saddam Hussein posed a threat to international peace and security. Building on earlier resolutions that there was one more chance to disarm, that there would be renewed inspections, and that if not, they would face serious consequences. Now, at that point, they put inspectors in. That's not something, by the way, that many in this administration ever wanted. If you go back and look at statements by many in the administration over the summer, they were declaring that inspections had no role, that they were useless, and those people were arguing against ever going to the Security Council at all. Then what happens? Well, sometime in January, there is a clear breakdown in trust between the French and the Americans, that the Colin Powell certainly thought he had agreement from the French that they would send inspectors in, but that at some point there would be a determination as to whether there had been compliance, and that the French would be willing at some point to join in a resolution authorizing the use of force. The French then announced in January, February, for reasons known only to Jacques Chirac, that essentially the problem was the U.S., not Saddam Hussein, and that nothing would lead them to authorize a use of force. At that point, the calculations changed. At that point, even Colin Powell and Tony Blair, who had been pushing the strongest for a Security Council resolution, agreed that it might be completely impossible ever to get one, and that when you had troops in the desert and you were never going to be able to get a resolution, then you should go ahead. But 3 weeks before the final breakdown, the French ambassador went to the White House and said, look, don't seek a second resolution. Let's just agree to disagree, as we did in Kosovo. Go ahead and use force, and then we'll come together after the fact and see what can be done. That is not the failure of the Council. It is a failure of diplomacy, and we missed an opportunity to have a united community behind the use of force, but it doesn't mean that the Council is now broken. It means you need to come together and figure out how you avoid that ultimate breakdown when we face North Korea or we face any number of threats.
All right, let's talk about that for a minute, because there was some shock in some quarters when France and Russia and China said that they were going to block any second resolution. Was this really all about Iraq, or was this more about them trying to foil the unilateral power of the United States? And if so, does that give us some clue as to how we go forward to try and fix the Security Council, Michael?
Well, of course, it was about the effort of those powers to establish what they regard as a multipolar world. They've said all along that that is their long-term objective. China and Russia, 2 years ago, entered into a treaty positing as their goal to return to a multipolar world. France has been very forthright. Its objective, it said, was to strengthen the UN Security Council. Its objective was not to disarm Iraq. And I might just say, I think that it's important for people to realize Anne-Marie and I, as much as I like Anne-Marie, we're starting from very different premises here. Anne-Marie has, throughout this dialogue, the long dialogue on the war, that is, not just the dialogue this morning, really premised her entire analysis on an imaginary consensus, on an agreement that does not exist. March 2nd, here's what you said. The Charter's vision is closer to being realized than at any time since the UN's founding in 1945. What is happening today is exactly what the UN founders envisioned. If the war is successful, the UN is very likely to authorize the action after the fact. We know today that that's baloney. March 3rd, you said that CNN. March 3rd, we'll get our resolution and go to war with the world community behind us.
Okay, but to the point, Michael, what's wrong with that?
Well, the point is that it's happy talk. It's Lawrence Welk music. It assumes a consensus that does not exist. She is fully unwilling to acknowledge the extent of disagreement in the world today and the depth of division in the world community. That is the essential prerequisite for subjecting the use of force to the rule of law. You've got to have agreement on fundamental values, and we don't have that in the world today.
Okay, Anne-Marie, I know you need a chance to defend yourself here.
I mean, on the contrary, I mean, I agree. The final point is precisely that we need some kind of collective authorization of the use of force. Otherwise, as I started out, we are back in anarchy, and I still haven't heard a proposal other than trying to go back to the Security Council and reform it. And my hardly happy talk. I mean, I have never been more worried about the state of international cooperation and international security, and I am working extremely hard to make sure that there is still a possibility that we can regulate this collectively. But I absolutely stand by what I said leading up to the final breakdown. And as I said, up to 3 weeks before the final breakdown, the French were basically saying to the Americans, look, let's just agree to disagree like Kosovo, which was the model. As Mike himself said, the threats have changed, the nature of warfare has changed. In Kosovo and in other settings in the 1990s, we had situations where you needed to use force to stop a humanitarian crisis. Kofi Annan himself recognized the UN needed to be able to do that, or it was going to be irrelevant. Now we have a situation where, in addition to humanitarian crises, you have situations of gross and systematic human rights abuses plus weapons of mass destruction. It's a very dangerous combination. The UN has to be able to address those. It was very, very close. And what we did see, unlike most of the Cold War, when the major powers simply ignored the UN, was the U.S. went to the UN, France, Russia, and Germany and China were on the front pages. People on Wall Street, people on Main Street are looking to what the UN is about to decide. And what I argued, and I stand by it, was that was closer to the founders' vision of what the UN was supposed to be than at any time going back probably to the Korean War when it was a Uniting for Peace resolution. Polls still bear that out. Americans know more about the UN than they ever had before, and they still support going to the UN in the next crisis. What we
I need to stop you. I need to stop you here because we have a lot of callers who really want to get in on this conversation. Let's go to the phone lines now to Ashland, Massachusetts, where Imran is calling from. Hi, Imran.
Hi. I have a question and a comment. And the question is, why did the League of Nations fail? And are there lessons that could be learned from the League of Nations that could be applied towards the Security Council? And then the comment I have is that it seems to me that on the issue of, you know, is the UN relevant, it strikes me that relevancy only occurs when you want to make something relevant. And so if the U.S. decides that it wants to make it irrelevant, it simply does so, and it's only by its own actions that it puts credibility into the UN. And I think the clearest example, to my mind, is the enforcement of UN resolutions, where In the case of Iraq, that was the basis for determining whether we should go to war with them. But then, as many in the Middle East will often point out, well, if it's UN resolutions that are the issue or violations of it, why aren't we doing anything against Israel? And I think our America's position of determining what resolutions are relevant to push and which aren't really kind of makes the UN look uncredible.
Okay, Imran, thanks for the call. We're going to address your comment. The question about the League of Nations is something that we did talk about earlier in the program. Sorry you missed it. Michael, what about that point?
Well, why did the League of Nations fail? What are the lessons that can be applied to the Security Council? That's a good question. The League of Nations failed fundamentally because it was based on a vision of the world as we would like it to be. It was based on an imaginary world. It wasn't based on a recognition of how nations actually behave. That's the lesson that we need to bring to our efforts to either restructure the Security Council to fix it or to come up with something better. We've got to fashion rules based upon the world as it exists, not an imaginary world as we would prefer it to exist.
What about his larger point about if the United States decides that the UN Security Council isn't relevant, you know, can it be?
Well, I mean, it's not simply up to the United States. Look, France, Britain, Russia, China all have roles to play. And as I've said, they are engaged in a process and an effort to bring down the United States a peg, not Britain, but our power competitors. France, Russia, and China have used the Security Council as a tool to try to reduce American power in the world. And the United States is trying to use the Security Council as a tool to enhance its power. These are incompatible objectives, and that was the principal reason for the train wreck that we saw last fall.
All right, let's take another call now. We're going to Raleigh, North Carolina, where Phil is phoning in. Hello, Phil.
Hey. I was calling basically to solicit commentary from your guests on a point related to the rules whereby the UN operates and why I think that may lead to irrelevancy in the future. I was, surprised that France and, for that matter, Germany have veto power in this in the UN. When you consider their place in the world, relatively small countries, it seems odd that they can derail an entire process such as what they did, such as what France did during this situation. And also, why there aren't means of circumventing a veto, for example, you know, obtaining a larger majority to overrule France's veto or something of that nature, that in conjunction with the fact that there isn't any means of enforcing the resolutions, I think, stand in the way of the UN being a truly effective force.
All right. Thank you so much for the call, Phil. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. And Marie, what about that point? If you have rules but no way of enforcing them, then what's the point of having rules?
Well, that's the conundrum of much of international law. International institutions never have direct enforcement power in the same way that domestic governments do. You can't call in the troops and enforce, or call in the federal marshals, the global marshals, and enforce things, which is why institutions like the UN and the League before it have to be political as well as legal, and they have to be founded on consistent with a configuration of power so that they operate in nations' interests. And Michael and I think, agree that we need real reform now to take account of both power shifts, but also to take account of new threats. The question is really, are we going to have a situation in which the UN is the way in which the rest of the world balances against the U.S., which is the vision that I think I hear Michael putting forward, or are we going to have a revised UN where the U.S. and other major powers can agree to address common threats? The issue is, for other countries in the world, as France portrays it, is U.S. power. I think the U.S. has a legitimate response to say, no, there are threats out there that threaten all of us, and we must be able to work together to address them. Only if at least most of the major powers agree will you be able to enforce UN resolutions. That's absolutely right.
You know, Anne-Marie, the caller raised a question that I didn't hear you respond to. He raised a question about the French veto. And the question essentially is this. If the United States comes to the conclusion, say backed by the United States Congress, that a certain action, certain use of force is essential to protect its national security, should the United States permit France to block that action?
Now you seem to be coming from a very different point of view. The UN is premised on the idea that, obviously, in self-defense, nobody can block it. And I think you're right to say if the U.S. perceives that its vital security interests are at stake, indeed, if any nation thinks its vital security interests are at stake, it is going to defend them. The question is whether or not it tries to work through an international organization and whether or not that organization has a chance to try to work collectively, as almost happened here. I refuse to accept the idea that this was sort of written in stone from the beginning. If it fails, obviously, in the end, nations are going to do what they think they have to do.
So you yourself do not believe the United States should see itself as bound by the French veto?
It's not a question of should. Yes, I want a situation in which the United States is going to play by the rules as much as it possibly can, and all nations are. I'm going to accept that because international law is radically imperfect, that there are going to be plenty of cases in which the rules are going to break down, but that doesn't mean you don't try. That's always the world we live in. That is the world of international law. It's not a question of saying they should or shouldn't. It's a question of what is the best hope we have of maximizing collective authority for the use of force.
All right. We're going to be talking a lot more about this in our next segment. The United Nations Security Council is what we're speaking about this hour. Is it an irrelevant debating society or the vanguard of international law and order? If it is, in fact, broken, can it be fixed? Should it be fixed? And if so, how? Connection listeners, we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-423-8255 is our number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris, and this is The Connection on NPR. In the months preceding the war in Iraq, President Bush laid it on the line with the UN, challenging it to stand up to Iraq and serve the purpose of its founding. Did it? Is the Security Council obsolete or just in need of a tune-up? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, we invite you to. Michael, I want to ask, a little earlier in the program, Anne-Marie was making the basic point that, well, you know, it may be an imperfect international organization, but basically it's the only one we have. And I'm wondering what lessons we can take from where we are now, looking ahead to issues like North Korea. Clearly, that's a big one staring us right in the face.
That's an extremely important question, of course. This is a very serious crisis. I'm afraid there's not much grounds for optimism here. Last Thursday, April 9th, the Security Council deadlocked again, this time on Korea. The United States and the United Kingdom had proposed a statement in the Security Council criticizing North Korea for its abrogation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And China and Russia, again, opposed the United States. And so I think we're off to a very bad start. The likelihood is that these same forces that we saw divide the council during the war, a run-up to the war on Iraq, are going to divide the council again on Korea. It's less we need the United Nations less now than we did before, perhaps, with respect to Korea, only because North Korea has backed down and, as a result, apparently, of what we did in Iraq, accepted multilateral talks. But that's no thanks to the United Nations. Everybody's been urging the United States to go it alone in dealing with this problem. We haven't gotten anybody on the Security Council to lift a finger in helping us with this, by all accounts. Certainly the Security Council has been pretty quiescent. So I am not optimistic that the Security Council is going to play any useful role in addressing Korea.
And Marie, how possible will the United States find it to go alone, and how well-equipped will the UN be to deal with problems like North Korea going forward?
Well, the United States certainly can go it alone. It can always go it alone. The question is, as it does go it alone, it makes it easier and easier for other nations to say and act on the premise that the United States is the greatest threat to international peace and security, which was the French position. The problem is we may be fiddling while Rome burns. I mean, in the meantime, you've got real threats like North Korea, like the support of terrorism on the part of many governments. And the question then is, you know, again, what is the alternative? I mean, Mike, are you saying it's because the Security Council can't help, we should go it alone? I'm trying to figure out what's the positive proposal as to where we go from here?
Well, look, I've never declared the United Nations dead. There are lots of things that the United Nations can do. As the administration has said, with respect to Iraq, they have lots of expertise in post-war reconstruction that we ought to call on. I think, for example, that we ought to bring in the United Nations to help set up tribunals to try the leading Iraqi figures who engaged in very serious crimes against humanity. We ought to set up mixed tribunals of the sort that we have in Sierra Leone, for example, with people from other countries joining in with Iraqis. And I think the United Nations could very well and properly oversee that. I don't think that the United Nations is going to be able to play any role of managing or directing the post-war reconstruction in Iraq. The United States and Britain simply are not going to allow them to play that. And frankly, contrary to what you've proposed, I don't think that France, Russia, and China are going to participate in that precisely because it would constitute some kind of ex post facto authorization. Let me just finish. So the central task of the United Nations is one that we ought to be clear about. It's maintaining international peace and security. Its job is to manage the use of force. And to the extent that that touches upon the upper hierarchy of world power and how the United States stands in that hierarchy in relation to France and Russia and China, I do not believe that the Security Council is going to have any effective role to play.
We want to take a quick call, but Anne-Marie, I do want to give you a chance to respond to that for a moment.
Okay, but I think then you're agreeing. You're saying, of course, the UN can keep doing good works, and I've suggested also they set up a mixed tribunal. But you're simply saying they can't do what their principal job is, which is to try to regulate the use of force. And so what? So we should recommend that the U.S. just go alone? I mean, what's the positive proposal for regulating the use of force absent the U.N.? Do we just accept that it can't happen nation does what it wants?
I appreciate your question, Anne-Marie, but again, I just underscore my answer. You and I are starting from very different premises. My whole point is that in order to make a legalist regime work that governs the use of force, certain prerequisites have to be met. You need a consensus on basic underlying values. That consensus is not present in the world today. And I just repeat my suggestion earlier, you seem utterly unable and unwilling to recognize that.
I completely recognize the fact that the consensus is eroding quickly, but I don't think it's over, and I think we were very close. But I want to know, so you accept, let's say I agree with you. What I want to know is, what then? Do we try for a new international organization or what? What do we do as international lawyers? Let's say I accept your proposal.
Why don't you tell us what sort of reasonable international institution can be built on ground that is a swamp?
Actually, Anne-Marie, before I give you a chance to answer that, we have callers who really do want to be part of this conversation. Lois is phoning in from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hello, Lois.
Hi there. First of all, thank you for taking another caller from Raleigh. A quick comment and a question. I just, with all due respect to Michael, don't understand his point and am very much in agreement with Anne-Marie. And then the question is, which is the whole premise of this talk today, is how I very much do believe in the UN. I do believe we need to revise it. What are your suggestions, both of you, on how we can truly, what are some positive things that we can do to make the United Nations be effective in its role and its original charter.
Anne Marie, why don't you start on that one? Thanks for the call, Lois.
Thank you. Well, in the first place, I think we don't give up because to give up is to play into the hands of those in this administration that would like to see the UN basically destroyed as a organization for international peace and security. Instead, we come back to France and to Russia and to China with Britain, which is very supportive of this effort, and we say, look, we need some new ground rules. One, we're going to need to find a way to legitimate humanitarian intervention in some cases. And two, we need to be able to argue in some cases for regime change within the Security Council. I've proposed that where you have grave and systematic human rights abuses, like some killing 2 million of your own people, having no internal constraints at all, and you have weapons of mass destruction and evidence of aggressive intent, the Security Council must recognize that it must use all its power, and let's hope that's short of the use of force, to actually force changes in governments in those extreme circumstances. Because if it can't be done within the UN, then it's going to be done outside the UN, and the consequences are going to be much, much graver.
And, Michael, well, I take it that you're not totally persuaded that the Security Council, at least part of it, is fixable.
I just return to my earlier point. She just assumes an imaginary world. The Security Council is never going to approve a resolution that is a blank check for other states to attack Iran, Syria, and North Korea.
Not.
That's what
of
you're proposing,
Anne-Marie.
Michael, let me finish.
Stop saying I'm in some happy world. Believe me, I live in the world we're in, and I've never been more worried about it.
I'm glad to hear that, Anne-Marie.
Well, everything I've said or written is pretty clear about that.
The question is, where should we start? How should we think about this problem? I think that the first task is, rather than to rearrange deck chairs on the Titanic, as you are prone to do, I would like to see us recognize that the system has failed. The system does not work. We really need to go back to the drawing boards and start from square one and think through what we can come up with for the current world power structure that is not going to change anytime soon, that allows us to help reduce, if not eliminate, human suffering caused by the use of force.
Well, no one could agree more than I, but are you proposing a new San Francisco conference where we just ignore the existing UN and get all nations together to create a new institution? I don't see how we're going to be able to do that. We've got the institution we've got. You need to come back with an actual, if you think there are resolutions the Security Council would pass other than mine, I'd love to hear them. I'm all for it. That's the debate we need to have.
We need to start from a point different from what is happening today is exactly what the UN founders envisioned. It's not.
What was happening was very close, and we missed it.
Baloney.
Well, you're listening to The Connection on NPR, and we want to go to the phone lines. Dan is calling in from Madison, Wisconsin. Hello, Dan.
Hey there. I very much support the pursuit and hope that in the promise of international legal structures. I just wanted to share a cynicism I have that relates to where power is located and would like to hear your thoughts. First, states are typically or almost uniformly, I would say, not representative of their diverse domestic communities. And secondly, states are prepared to commit resources and incur risks only when their individual interests are advanced. And these interests are usually calculated according to dangerously short-term perspectives of the ruling elites, whether we're talking about the U.S., China, or elsewhere.
Michael, you want to start with that one?
It sounds right to me.
It sounds right to me, too. That is indeed the premise of international organizations in a world where there's no central power. And I think as I hear the difference between Michael and me, he's saying there is an irrevocable breakdown and you have, you know, three powers on one side and the U.S. and Britain on the other. And because of that, the Security Council can't function. And I'm saying, well, the U.N. was premised on the idea that you had to take the interests of the great powers into account, and now you have to figure out where there is any common ground. I'm just more hopeful that there still can be common ground than he is in terms of the notion that there are some threats we all face. I also think the U.S. will have to accept more constraints on its power than it's been willing to do, but I think it will when it understands how difficult the rest of the world can make it for it to accomplish its objectives.
I think Anne-Marie is correct about that. Roosevelt's Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, told Roosevelt that the entire plan is based on the assumption that the major powers will cooperate with each other. The reason for this failure is cooperation is broken down among the major powers.
So where do we go from here?
We begin with a reality check and ask ourselves why the system is broken down. And
Michael, we agree on why it's broken down. I'm asking do we go from here?
Anne-Marie, I'm sorry, we don't agree on why it's broken down. You assume a consensus that does not exist on the world.
I don't. I agree that there isn't a consensus right now, but I agree that I said there almost was. There was agreement that we all needed to disarm Saddam Hussein. There was disagreement on whether that could ever be done without the use of force. And if you would like to defend Jacques Chirac's decision to make the U.S. the problem rather than Saddam Hussein the problem, there are a lot of good domestic political reasons, but it's not in France. But it is not the view of the rest of the Security Council, and we were very close.
Anne-Marie, how do you build a legalist institution without a consensus on underlying values?
I still think there is consensus
on
values.
You just told us that you recognized that there was none.
I said that I recognize that right now we are in an absolute impasse.
You can't have it both ways.
No, I said we're at an impasse. I agree with you. The question is it the fact that where we are is a situation in which the UN becomes the vehicle for other powers to balance against the U.S. They will not play a central role in the regulation of the use of force by your own admission, because they'll just be out there trying to balance the U.S., and the U.S. will be in a position where it can do whatever its military might allows it to do so. Or do all nations, including the United States and France and Russia and Britain and others, recognize that actually they all have a greater interest in preserving an institution that can do some things some of the time?
Well, we seem to be at an impasse as well. We thank you both so much for being with us. Michael Glennon is professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University.
Thanks, Michael. Thank you.
And Anne-Marie Slaughter is dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University.
Thanks
Anne-Marie.
Much. Thank you.
To continue the conversation, you can visit the forums at our website, www.theconnection.org. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection.